I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, my name's Stuart Miles and welcome to the Apocalypse Podcast. Samsung has finally confirmed the date it's expected to announce the Samsung Galaxy S22 range. But what's the story so far and should you be excited? Apocalypse Mike Lowe has been following what's been happening and joins me to detail what we should be expecting on the 9th of February. Last month, I caught up with principal UX designer of TomTom to discuss the company's new digital cockpit software platform for car makers that hopes will change the way we interact with our cars, and had plenty of questions. And Apocalypse's Rick Henderson has been playing the Uncharted Legacy of Thieves collection, a remastering of the last two titles for the PlayStation 5 users. Are they worth revisiting? Stay tuned to find out. First, back to you, Mike. What's been happening with Samsung?
Hello. Well, it's all a bit of conjecture at the moment, because the only thing we know is that the date for what's called Galaxy Unpacked is on the 9th of February. Right. And pretty much year on year, that tells you that here comes the new flagship Galaxy phones this year, 2022. It should follow a pretty similar format, actually, to previous. So the expectation is we're going to have a trio of handsets, which would be the S22, S22 Plus, and the big one, the S22 Ultra.
Now, do we see, is it, in some instances, some years, we just see a kind of incremental movement, you know, hey, look, it's a new processor, it's new, more powerful things, but within very much the same design. Yeah. Are we likely to see a refresh of the design, or are they going to sort of take that things easy this year?
I think we've spoken before kind of at length about how this idea of refinement is becoming a very kind of strong thing within different companies. And in one sense, I would see Samsung as being kind of like the Apple in the Android phone market. So what we're kind of expecting is not a dramatic change between what we've seen in the S21 from last year. It will follow a design change as far as we can see from various leaks that have happened. But it's kind of a more refinement kind of point of view. So the camera enclosure on the rear is a particular change that's changed each year. Last year it was almost like a little kind of corner piece that popped out a bit. This time it looks as though it's going to be much more kind of pared down, really kind of simplistic looking, more part of the body of the phone, kind of less protrusion right. than has happened previously. So it just looks kind of neater and tidier, and there's some nice kind of flatter colors, and just looks that little bit more contemporary, really. But also there seems to be a shift in how things are sized. So, and we've seen this across, you know, multiple manufacturers this year. Not everyone wants a massive phone. So it looks as though, and I'm not saying it's a small device, but the entry-level model is going to be pretty much bang on the 6-inch point rather than any larger. And then the Plus will be a bit bigger and the Ultra will be bigger again. So it actually gives some proper segregation between kind of your entry-level products, mid-level and the top end.
And is there any sort of rumors? And I know all of this stuff is rumored so far. There hasn't been any, apart from the date, there hasn't been any confirmation of what's to come. That bear in mind, though, is there any rumors so far that you thought, oh, I'm actually quite excited about that? That seems interesting.
The really big thing is, and it's been discussed for quite a long time, the Ultra model looks pretty much to replace what was the Note range. So there's a pretty strong rumor that the Ultra and the Ultra only will be the one to come with what Samsung calls S Pen, which is its stylus integrated within the body. So it's a bit of a step change, or at least a naming change for how that's going to be seen and used. Quite an interesting choice to no longer put any kind of separation in terms of branding between having and using a stylus on a phone, because obviously it's not for everybody. And the fact it's thought to be included is quite a big jump, really. So it almost makes the Ultra a little bit like the new Note in a way. But then all of them should, in theory, we believe, be compatible with the stylus anyway. It just won't be possible to integrate it into the body of any except for the Ultra model, basically.
And we've obviously just had a spate of phone launches from the Chinese brands, new Huawei's, new Xiaomi's and things like that. Does this come into a market that will it be able to stand up on its own, or are they going to be ahead of the curve, do you believe, or do you think they're still, you know, the Chinese have actually come up with some stuff that's going to make them look a bit
I think what Samsung's really doing with this is just being kind of confident in knowing it can deliver in the important areas. So the more entry models, the 22 and the Plus, will come with higher resolution cameras. There's other features that we know Samsung can do. So like in the Fold that came out, as in the foldable device earlier in the year, not this year, sorry, last year, 2021, that had a underscreen camera. We're not expecting that at all across the S22 range, because I think this kind of whole set looks to be about what can be done really well with sort of no questions asked. We know there's going to be a punch hole camera on the front. That's fine. People are used to that. And I think it's not necessarily about standing out in kind of big look at me kind of ways. It's kind of saying, this is the most refined kind of Android handset you can buy. And over the years, they've been so successful, as I say, they're almost like the kind of Apple equivalent in Android. So it's very much like, I think, quite a design point standout rather than any of those kind of massive giant features that are new and exciting, but not necessarily ready for market. Whereas everything here looks to be that it's going to be a really kind of solid offering.
Still to come, Rick gives us his verdict on the Uncharted Legacy of Thieves collection.
For the test, I played the PS4 version of Uncharted 4 for a little while and the PS5 version. And it was that moment where you suddenly realise how long you spent just waiting for things to load on the last generation of consoles.
TomTom is a name synonymous with in-car navigation, having been one of the first companies to offer standalone in-car devices that we stuck to our windscreens. The company might not be the household name it once was, but its data still powers many of the navigation systems we all use in our cars today. Its next evolution is TomTom Indigo, an open digital cockpit software platform for car makers that hopes to revive the company's fortunes and power the next wave of innovation in our cars. But how do you go about creating such a system, and what's involved? I recently chatted to Drew Meehan, TomTom's principal UX designer and someone I've known for several years, to talk about just that. I started by asking what an open digital cockpit software platform actually does.
Yeah, so I think this is something that it steps off what we're already doing and what we're already great at, right? Which is in-car navigation. A lot of people don't realize maybe that they have TomTom navigation in their cars, but a lot of people actually do. And our services as well, like traffic or live updates on things, that actually come through a lot of the world's cars. What Indigo is, as this open platform for digital cockpit, is really a base for car makers to build the entire infotainment system. So that really means every part of what you would see on your screens in a car. The platform itself is a sort of extensible, customizable baseline framework that the car makers can sort of tailor to whatever they need, right? And we've designed it as such because we feel like there's a little bit of a gap in the market right now, both from a user side and also from a car maker side, sort of what the needs are.
Now, companies like Google and Apple with CarPlay and Android Auto have already started to try and attempt to do this. What makes TomTom believe that their approach is going to be better?
Yeah, so the difference between Android Auto and CarPlay is that they are really just projections from a phone onto an existing in-car experience. So everything that's happening in the cluster, so the part that's behind your steering wheel, speed and fuel and that kind of information, what's happening around the center with media, but also heat and cooling and you know, all of the in-car settings. So, you know, especially these days with electric vehicles, you have a lot more settings. You have regeneration settings, and maybe you can visualize how much of your battery is charging while you're braking and things like that. Indigo is all of that. It's all of the cluster. It's all of the head unit or the center stack, you know, the main screen between the driver and the passenger experience. It integrates all of the media experiences, but also all of the previously, let's call them car-centric experiences, right? The things that actually control things in your car. Indigo does all of those. It's not simply for the sort of overlay of maps and entertainment. It's actually just built in. The navigation, the media is just part of it. It's built to sort of be able to take in. It's an open platform. So essentially apps can be added on, but they're fully integrated experience. So you get your media, your music, even potentially video in certain circumstances, right? If you're stopped to charging your car or something, maybe you have video. All of those things can be built right in. And it also is built to work with as many screens as the car has. And we know that, you know, screens are kind of expanding, right? Every car company seems to be adding more and more screens, maybe for backseat passengers, maybe for the front seat passenger. And Indigo actually accommodates all of that with one one continuous experience, one seamless experience that goes through all of those screens and is built all in one place.
And as someone who's worked on the UX side of things within the automotive industry for a long time and have seen that transition from buttons to screens, has that made your life easier or more complex?
Well, that is a tough question. I'll be honest, I still love some buttons in my car. In many ways, it makes it more complex. A hard control actually, you know, is something that's very fixed and set, and you don't have to work around. For example, is music playing at the same time? It doesn't matter if music is playing. The knob controls the temperature, and not, sure, you know, not the other way around. And that's a big part of what we're trying to solve, right? Create a user experience that those pieces don't feel sort of, you know, stitched together. They feel seamless. They feel completely integrated. So the HVAC, as we call it, the heating and cooling, temperature controls, you know, they're integrated in a way that it doesn't feel like they're interfering. They don't overlap. They don't sort of, you know, the notifications and things are designed to be prioritized. They have a logic and an algorithm so that you don't get a music notification instead of your next turn indication, for example, because they're not interfering, right? They're working together in the back end to create that sort of front end that's really useful for the driver.
And you talk about, you know, this sort of, now cars have got even bigger screens and that transition to designing for those. Are there any challenges apart from, you know, things overlapping and stuff that really that you're finding that you're trying to solve?
Yes, there are a huge number of challenges. Bigger screens, more screens, each new thing creates a new challenge. That can be everything from the very small, let's say, you know, just the sheer size of the screen means that some of the screen is actually going to be below your normal glance point, right? You want to keep, when you're in a car, reducing distraction is partly about, you know, clarity and how things are shown and the good size so that you can actually read it while you're driving. But another part of that is very physical, right? That when you're looking out the windscreen, you want to be able to glance. So what we call a visual arc, right? That if you imagine taking your eyes off and doing a quick glance, you want to be able to sort of scroll across a quick arc. Those are that's the information where you're gonna see first and easiest, right? And we actually do user testing with eye tracking glasses to see if people can sort of use our systems in that way. The problem is every new car company comes out with a new layout and a new screen, and you kind of need to retest all of those things again. You need to say, oh, well, actually now this needs to be further up the screen because otherwise it's buried too low and people, you know, drivers can't see it while they're driving, or maybe actually the physical touch point on the screen means that something is you know, you can't pinpoint the close button, for example. So it, with Indigo, one of the things we did based on user testing was actually we went with swipes to dismiss notifications, for example, because we found that you know, users had trouble finding that X to close a little panel or a little window that popped up, which on a smartphone or on a computer is not a problem at all. But in a car, in a moving vehicle, you need to minimize that kind of distraction and that kind of glance. And even if it's maybe, you know, the difference between a second and a half to a second can make a huge difference in a driving scenario.
Now, within the wider industry outside of the automotive world, we obviously went from buttons, i.e. touch, you know, phones with keypads, to screens. And in more recent years, we've started to see, you know, the use of voice and other kind of interface paradigms, so to speak. Do you foresee that to happen in the same as cars? Do you think this shift to screens is a temporary solution before we all shift to voice, or before we shift to, you know, augmented reality on the displays or things like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, voice is fully integrated into Indigo as well, because we do think that it's a big part of the sort of safe future, you know, use of an in-car system, right? So different voice providers are actually already supported out of the box. It's part of what we're trying to provide is a kind of quick startup for anyone using the Indigo platform to really get moving with the sort of best in class right from the beginning, right? We've kind of built that all in. We've tested it all. We know how it works. And you just get it as part of the package. I think that when it comes to augmented reality, whether that means that screens are going to go away, I think screens are going to be here for quite a long time. There is a lot of visual feedback that is quite useful. I think that they will diminish a little bit in their value as interaction devices, perhaps, but there is still a lot of physical demands around, for example, maps and ADAS, so, you know, driver assisted systems,
right?
You know, those kinds of things are really useful to be visualized. So I think what we're going to see is a shift from you know, screens that are kind of just emulate what a phone did but stuck to your dashboard, to screens that provide really valuable feedback about what the car is doing. And that even if you're doing voice searches, for example, we know that users still want to see that location on the map in response to their voice search as confirmation. It's reassurance. It creates confidence and trust in what the car is doing, right? You don't want to just go and trust that the voice assistant did what you wanted. You want to see that. And the same goes for advanced driver assistance systems. And again, Indigo is built to be able to visualize all those things from the beginning, right? We're looking to the future and even to automated driving and you know, what that means for how these things will change once you're maybe partially hands off the wheel or slightly a different position there.
And that's the sort of the kind of the end point of the conversation, isn't it? Is that we're talking already within the automotive industry of wheelless cars, you know, steering wheelless cars, as the idea of what a car does changes. And how do you think what potential opportunities or threats does that give UX within the vehicle when you can't even necessarily control it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the in-car user experience is going to have to shift perspective from one where you are creating a sort of information for acting upon, which is what you currently have, right? We tell a driver what they need to do, to one where it's information for reassurance or one for confidence. It doesn't mean that those in-car systems are going to go away, but they will need to sort of switch modes how they present information. That information is going to be needed in a way to, you know, maybe know if a car is automated, really automated, and I still think we're quite a few years off from the sort of full level 5 automation, but let's just say we are there. I think, you know, you're still going to be in a car, right? So the airplane is not a sort of good analog. You know, an airplane goes straight and it's smooth and you don't have to really think about it. A car is still going to go around sharp turns. It's still going to have speed humps. It's still going to have potholes and things that it needs to sort of navigate. So you might need to inform a driver, for example, that that's going to happen. And you may need to, even route around them. So part of the navigation might be, a choice to say, well, I want this to be as automated as possible. And we think that Indigo as a platform, because it's such an open tool and it has the sort of development, portal that apps can be developed quickly and be fully integrated into the system, it will allow that kind of extensibility. Any manufacturer can come along, they could build a car for right now, but if they wanted to push that limit and have automated driving as part of their system, there's no reason that they or a third party couldn't easily develop that and integrate it right in and sort of change that and have that, part of already the built-in systems from the beginning.
And my final question is I know that Indigo is obviously, it's just starting its journey, no pun intended, yes, on that. When do you perceive listeners will be able to see this in a car, in a real life environment?
Yeah, well, we already have a customer signed up. So they'll be able to see this in a real production car. I think I don't want to get the date wrong, but I think it's end of 2022, maybe beginning of 2023 is the actual start of production. And I think they'll see it sort of actually working in an in-car environment before that, Q2 of 2022, that will be showing, I think, the first sort of prototype versions of that car that we've been working on with the partner.
The Uncharted series has been a phenomenal success for Sony over the years, both financially and critical. But we haven't had a new game since The Lost Legacy in 2017. And with an Uncharted movie now doing the rounds, the new outing for Nathan Drake and its chums is long overdue. Uncharted Legacy of Thieves Collection isn't that, but it is a chance to replay the last two outings remastered for the PS5. But should you bother? Well, Pocalypse Rick Henderson has been playing through the games. I think you've completed them, haven't you, Rick?
Yeah.
But once again, to find out whether they're any good. So, Rick, is it a thumbs up?
Yeah, definitely a thumbs up, mainly for newcomers, obviously. We're talking about two of the PlayStation 4's best titles, repackaged, remastered within inverted quotes, for the PlayStation 5. So you're getting two amazing games, regardless of anything else. But for seasoned players who have already played them, there might be less of a reason to go back, but I still think it's worth it.
So the question I have for you before we start talking about the PlayStation 5 version, is this available for the PlayStation 4 in the sense that if I haven't managed to get around for some reason of playing the last two games, I can do it and enjoy a remastered version anyway?
No. The collection is PS5 exclusive for now. It will be also available for PC later this year. The main reason being is that the enhancements are PS5 only enhancements. You can actually buy a collection pack or a double pack of Uncharted 4, A Thief's End and Uncharted Lost Legacy anyway. So, and in fact, before we even get into the nitty gritty of the enhancements, etc., I have a tip for listeners. Sony is happily letting people upgrade to the PS5 collection if they own either of the two games on PS4. Okay. So, and that will cost you, I think it's £10 or $10, depending on your region. So you can actually get the collection for really cheap if you only buy one of the games. And the big tip is if you go onto an online retailer such as Amazon, then you can find the original Uncharted 4 on PS4 for about £14. Considering the collection is around £49, that's a good tip on getting it cheap.
As Blackadder would say, that's more cunning than a fox with a degree of cunningness from Cambridge.
Yeah, indeed.
Right. So let's talk about the games themselves, though. So is the remaster worth it?
Right. Well, as I said earlier, the remaster is within inverted commas, because what you won't get is the sort of level of graphical rework as the previous Nathan Drake collection, which came out for PS4 based on the PS3 versions. That kind of overhauled all the graphics, made everything look much better. This one isn't that. basically because it doesn't need to be. Let's face it, Uncharted 4 and Uncharted Lost Legacy, they may be 5 and 6 years old, but they actually look like native PS5 games already.
Oh, wow.
They were so good at the time that, quite frankly, that A, they made my PS4 Pro sound like it was taking off at like a helicopter because the graphics chip was getting so hot. But they were so good at the time that they actually, the transition, they have aged really, really well. What you do get with the enhancements graphically is three separate new modes. You get native 4K. The originals weren't in 4K, even on PS4 Pro. But that runs at 30 frames per second. Right. You also get a performance mode, which is 1440p, but that runs at 60 frames per second. That's at, by far and away, our favorite mode. And you also get a 120 hertz option. Now, that runs the game at 1080p. It softens the graphics a bit, as you would imagine, because you're getting half the resolution. But the actual, if you have got an 120 hertz TV, it's worth having a go to see just how buttery smooth the game can run. I mean, it is ridiculously smooth. But I prefer the 60 frames per second mode because the smoothness is not as perceptible as the resolution drop.
Now, obviously, we talked about the graphic enhancements. Are there any differences to the game? Sometimes when studio remasters things, they go, oh, we're just throwing in this extra level, or we've thrown in something, you know, some extra Easter eggs, or even an extra multiplayer version or whatever. I know Uncharted isn't multiplayer at all, but is there any difference to the gameplay at all?
No. In fact, there is one major difference, and it's actually a negative, in the fact that Uncharted 4, sometime after Uncharted 4 first released, they added a multiplayer mode, which was quite fun. It wasn't great. It wasn't like it didn't set the world on fire, but it was okay. That's gone. That's gone completely. The servers were closed down years ago. They probably didn't want to reopen them. So you actually lose an aspect of the original Uncharted 4. You don't gain any other gameplay amendments. There's no hidden secrets. There's no Easter eggs. The games are presented exactly as they were before, which is around combined 20 hours of action adventuring. Now, what you do get, as well as the graphics, though, is you get some of the other benefits of the PlayStation 5, namely some DualSense features, although they're quite subtle, so you don't really notice them. 3D audio if you've got a headset that's capable. But the most important one for me was faster loading times. And that made the games so much different. For the test, I played the PS4 version of Uncharted 4 for a little while and the PS5 version. And it was that moment where you suddenly realize how long you spent just waiting for things to load on the last generation of consoles. The amount of your life that you wasted just waiting for loading. Whereas the PlayStation 5 version is almost instant. It is perfect. You can get straight into the action.
And you talked about this briefly, about the sort of, you know, they've held up well. Sometimes our classic favourites, when you come to play it, you're like, oh my goodness, you know, this was bug ridden, or it was, you know, the story's inappropriate, or something's, you know, just the world's moved on. Did you find that was any, does that cause a problem, or is it just, you know, that's the final question, was it enjoyable to go back?
Yeah, very much enjoyable. I think Naughty Dog, the developer, is who also develops The Last of Us and previously Crash Bandicoot, are masters at storytelling and are very conscious of ensuring that a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and is captivating, doesn't need to use any kind of overly sensitive plot lines. I mean, ultimately, the Uncharted series is about treasure hunting in lands that you would never have visited, and it's a bit like a Bond film in the fact that it's big action sequences, etc. There's nothing. I mean, even the politics of it, it steers away from stereotypes of areas. There's some dodgy South African accents in the first game, but it doesn't stereotype South African people. For example, it just says that here's a mercenary group that just so happened to be from South Africa. So there is nothing. There's nothing that really touches on a nerve in the Uncharted series, and the voice acting throughout, the the work by Nolan North as Nathan Drake and Troy Baker as Sam Drake makes it a joy. The previous Uncharted, they were all very solitary adventures. You occasionally had an extra character or two,
yeah,
but they didn't really join you on the adventure. It was a very solitary adventure. These two games are very much a combined adventure. You still play the lead character, but someone else is always accompanying you. So there's banter throughout, there's talk. Having revisited them, I'd forgotten how good the Uncharted games really were. And now I just cannot wait for another one.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, pip pip.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.